Mr. Hay, reel 5. Now, you mentioned that you were a bit of a... Boxall took liked you, that you got on fairly well with him. What type of a man was he? Are there any stories you can tell that let us know a bit about him?
Well, when I first met him, I wanted to describe the ideal Colonel Blimp. I would describe him. He was stuffy, very stiff, the epitome of a First World War officer, with his, he modeled himself at, had the same sort of dress as Monty, these riding breeches, light putties, red tabs, and never a flicker on his face, a moustache, old-fashioned moustache, and didn't give anything away. Obviously, he'd been a good regimental officer, brought up in the right traditions, had done his work well in France, and that's how he came to Monty's attention, because I think he was in the same division with his East Summers. I didn't want anything to do with him, because I'd been sent to brigade against my will. I'd just come into regimental soldiering, and I realised, of course, they couldn't just send anyone who would not fit in at brigade headquarters. So it was really a feather in my cap to be sent there. And I say I was looking forward to being in the Durham Light Infantry and regimental soldiering. But I learnt a lot from him because, A, I knew how to behave in a mess. I had all that experience. And knew where to be. So ultimately, they made me PMC. In brigade headquarters, there was the brigadier, the brigade major, Seaford Highlander, and the staff captain, Gilbert Whitehead, I remember his name, and then attached to, oh yes, also there was a signals officer with his detachment. There was an intelligence officer and an MTO. Then there were we four stooges who were there to be contacts for our own.
Can we just have a look at what each one of those jobs entailed, as far as you saw it? You know, I mean, we can see what they were meant to do, perhaps, but what would they do within the 206 Brigade?
The Brigade Major had to oversee what the battalions were doing training-wise and the strategic work. Well, it was static, but it was his job. He got every week what every battalion was going to do, and then he went out himself to one of us and checked on things. I can't remember his name. Very tall, striking chap with his kilt, this Scottish crook, and magnificent figure. So people knew he was there and around, but a very sound man. And I didn't see him afterwards, but I'm sure he would go on to higher things.
And the staff captain?
Well, he was my administrator. He was a wicked character. And yes, sir, no, sir. Obviously, he did his job. He was tight of connections, but he didn't give us that much for it.
So, what type of admin was he dealing with? Just running the office, the brigade office?
Yes, well, yes, just like a company secretary, seeing that everything went to the right places.
And the intelligence officer?
The intelligence officer, well, had to know about not only our battalions, what they were, but obviously there was the floating population, the mobile population. First of all, the only with the 3rd Division commanded by Monty, which was the only fully equipped division in England after. They were given a static role, and Monty said, this is no good. We've got to be flexible and move around wherever we want. And which he did along the south coast, and in Monty's own words, he upset more mayors by saying, look, we're going to do this here, there, and they said, yeah, but you're going to spoil this, that, and the other. He said, we're at war. He said, the enemy's going to come any time. And he said, we've got to be prepared for it. Which he kept flinging at everybody.
So the IO kept the maps up to date.
Kept the maps, yeah.
And presumably the MCO arranged for any movements, although you were static.
Yes,
so
we didn't have much equipment or motor cars.
So you ran that. Those were the members of the mess that you. Now, what was your job as PMC then?
Can I just add that also in the mess there was a naval four-ring captain, Round Turner. What his job was, I don't know, but it was because you were on the shortest reach across the channel, and he was to monitor the military situation, just how the messages came through to him. He was off on his own. He was a nice chap, very intelligent, kept us all informed about this, that. But he missed the two warships that slipped past our front door, the guys now and the
Charnos.
They slipped through, which wasn't pretty good.
So what was your role as PMC then?
Well, it someone had to do it, and because I had experience before and I'd made one or two suggestions, I just really had to oversee. We were only 11 people. Two things. We all had our own little plastic cups with our own butter ration in, and when there was marmalade, we had that all separate. It wasn't put on them. And the brigadier said to me, he said, why haven't we got more marmalade? I said, ration, sir. He said, don't you know anybody? I said, oh, no, sir. Barely that. I said, and of course, I used to travel with him in the back of his car, and we used to have these little off-the-cuff chats. And I said, you have a lot of friends, sir. He said, well, I'll test it out. And we got a tin of marmalade, large tin, about £7. And I thought, great. So I put this, gave this to Cooper, I said, there we are. We've got the marmalade. That evening, we had marmalade pudding, which had used half the marmalade. So, and I was a black mark. But the other thing about being PMC, the Duke of Gloucester was coming for lunch. Of course, the Duke of Gloucester knew this part. He'd been in the with his regiment in that part of the camp. He knew it well. And he was coming, and we'd made inquiries of what he liked and what he didn't like, and somebody said, well, he'll take the army rations, but he's very, we got on to his ADC, he's very fond of raspberries. Well, near at hand, the brigadier was very friendly with Lady Dill, being the supremo, who had gone to America. So, but he was very friendly with her, and she had friends with gardens, and so I said, well, can you get around your friends there for these raspberries? And yes, he produced the raspberries, and we got fresh cream. I don't know what the other thing is. Anyhow, the brigadier, our mess was among trees, but it was just above the main road from Forks to Hythe, and it'd been almost in Hythe, a place called Sandgate. And the brigadier got himself all dolled up and was to meet the Duke of Gloucester. I was in the mess, just sitting about everything, to get the stores ready and things like that, when suddenly in bowled the Duke of Gloucester with his ADC, a fellow from the Scots Guards. There he was, sitting looking at him. He made himself at home, got his hat off, and I just said, "I'm here, sir." I said, "Have you missed the brigadier, sir?" Oh, he said, "I know my way here." He said, we also lost off the military policeman. And he'd come up, there was a private road up to this mess, which had, again, I think, been the commandant's house. But he knew this, and he had got him. So he said, "You'll have a drink, you'll have a drink, really, I suppose." So I said, "Well, what would you like, sir?" He said, "Pink gin." Pink gin. They drank about six large pink gins. Our ration was going down, but he did a little bit of chatting, but he was laughing his head off, as cheerful as they were coming. Then after, well, it must have been a full half hour I was there with them, I got out to the cook and said, "Get word to somebody, it doesn't matter who it is, that the delivery is way down on the road, that the Duke is in here." So eventually the brigadier came out. Anyhow, come to lunch, it was very good, and all very meaty, and the raspberries, and he didn't touch them. He's going to think about PNC. But again, he said to me, the brilliant, he said, "There's a lot of hearty laughter last night, because we used to wait, he went off and retired to his room after the meal, always this meal at the same time, because we didn't go out much, we couldn't go out much, we had to be around." And he said, "A lot of hearty laughter last night." Oh, I said, "Yes." I said, "We're playing a card game." And he more or less almost started picking me to go with him. He said, "Why don't you play the card game before I go to him?" Yeah, I said, "Well," I said, "I don't. I think it's a little bit of a vulgar game, sir." And I said, "We just didn't think that." Oh, he said, "I'll have a go." It was where not everybody could play, and you passed cards round and you bid for a certain card. It, not very good, but fun. And we really did have a lot of us. Well, the brigade, and then the brigade major was also came, and then the brigadier started to ask one or two people into dinner for this brigade that we had. But it became a feature of the mess, and it relaxed everybody.
Was there much drinking in the mess?
No.
So the Duke of Gloucester, that level of consumption was unusual.
Yes.
That's
oh, yes. He was a bit proud that we had it, but he did not. He had a much smaller head than I. He was a big chap, but a much smaller head, but he had this high-pitched laugh. But he was cheerful enough, and as I say, he was dressing most of his remarks to this Scots. But he did talk a lot to me about what was going on and who was in the barracks now, which he obviously knew and know and
So how would you spend, while you were attached to the staff, what would a typical day be like for you? I mean,
well, PT, I had a single room in the mess. PT, including the brigadier, 7 o'clock, and then 8 o'clock breakfast, and start your duties with the thing. I come on to something else, another duty I got, And then he had this meeting, 9 o'clock every morning, with the brigade major and the staff captain about the programme for the day. The brigade major had what everybody was doing, and you didn't know what the brigadier thought he'd do or if he had somebody else to see outside. And so he had first choice, and he'd say, all right, I'll take A, and the brigade major would take someone. So, and the staff captain didn't get in, but two were going round. I often went with the brigade major because he'd say, oh, you know something about these people, where they are, and he would save me a lot of time if you come. And it just worked like that. But then each battalion, each of the four battalions, had to take their turn to have a defence platoon attached. And they didn't obviously send an officer, whoever was there, and I was representing 17th, I had to take over defence platoon. Obviously, you didn't go out so much because you had to do your own duties. The defence platoon wasn't used so much.
What exactly was it? Who did it belong to?
It belonged to the 17th battalion or the other battalion. They said a complete platoon, but of course.
To your headquarters?
To go to the brigade headquarters.
So it was defensive, it was to defend the headquarters?
Yes. And the headquarters were all sandbagged up, and there was only one entrance to it, and so there was always a man fixed bayonet out the door, and behind there was the guard of about seven men and the sergeant with their orders, and nobody. All right, we were very careful about it because Monty really did get in fine detail, and nobody could get in without showing a pass anywhere because Monty was set up on this. So the day came when Monty was coming, knew he was coming, and he was going to do something, bring it up, forgot much about something about the defences. And so we picked our men for Gamma. Read the orders, not do it, but particularly about no one gets in without showing the pass. So, of course, I am behind, the sergeant of the guard is behind, and the brigadier is also standing there already, and Monty's entourage drew up in about four cars, I think, along with his military police at the other end, and cars, and he got out, and without noticing too well, behind him was a very tall general who I think became known as General Stopford. Anyhow, Monty had gone, got to there, your pastor, and it went something like this. You know who I am? Yes, sir. Will you show your pass, sir? I think it's an identity card. If you know who I am, I don't need to show it. Order, sir. So this friend of Monty, and he turned to Stopford, and I don't remember this word for that. He said, Stopford, you vouch for me. And, yes, sir. Show your identity. Stopford produced his own. He said, all right. And he was moving it. Half a man with it. No, okay. He said, by this time, the guard sergeant had come out. I'm sorry, sir. I've got to obey orders. You've got to show it. And he said, who's your commander? I said, Mr. Yes, sir. You better get him. So, of course, I'm presuming, you know. He said, what's all this nonsense about? They know who I am. And they've seen one that I said, written down on orders, sir. He said, do you show yours? Every time, sir. He said, does the brigadier show his? I said, yes, sir. And then they said, so this is a bloody bullet terrier. But anyhow, by this time, the brigadier has come out right in the face. And so that passed.
How was it resolved?
Oh, and nothing further was said.
They let him in the end.
A few days later, I had to go out with the brigadier and Monty, because he was going to pace out our sector was to be completely independent of Dover. Dover already had their fortifications, their underground tunnels and everything. We were on the escarpment and on the flat ground going down to Jim Church, where, you know, they expected the invasion to really land. They didn't expect them to climb up that place. But they knew this was the first place going down the big church marshes and all right. So it was all good for the country for landing for an invasion. Not that we didn't expect the parachutists first to come and do their work, and then for the ships, this was all worked out. So we were to, these were the only two places in this, in England, that were to be heavily defended and not given up the place, because they housed all the communications coming in from overseas in our sector. On the 5th of Dover, there was a listening post manned by the RAF, with all these superior RAF girl sergeants, various nationalities, but all linguists who were listening to everything. And that had to be defended at all costs, because this was the listening post for the whole war, really. And so it was essential then. So Monty would go with the brigadier and say what static defences were to be put up, because he wouldn't have them anywhere else. Linear defence along the coast. He said, we can't do it anyhow, it won't be any good, but this folks must be defended for these communications. So for 2 days I was given the net board, and I had a China graph pencil, and Monty was pacing. Alright, it was open country to the aerodrome, which is easy, and there were these concrete blocks about 6 feet, and he said, block up here, and then dannet wiring, three-tier dannet wiring and stakes, and he was detailing it all, and I was marking that, and we went round. The only civil part of this was at the end of the escarpment, going at the end of the cliffs, going down, there was a pub. I knew the pub because I was had lived in a bungalow with the 17th, and came lunchtime. We weren't far from this pub, and it was the brigadier who said to the Monty, "What about refreshments?" And I said, "You know, I'm some background." I said, "Well, we've got something in the car, the driver bring." And the brigadier said, would you like something from the pump? He said, "I don't drink." But he said, you have something. And he said, and he pointed to his ADC and says, "He drinks." So I went to the pub, and I got a jug of beer and three glasses on a tray, and took him at the ABC, and I sat some distance away while these two gentlemen. But that was a little bit human and interesting.
What did you think of Montgomery yourself as a man? From that's quite close contact you had with him.
Well, he was small. He had very beady eyes. I think he used those unnecessarily, bore them into you, as though, don't make a monkey of me, or don't give me a nonsense. It didn't put one at ease at all. He didn't say much to me.
Did you like him? I mean, there's no reason. I mean,
no. Naturally, I met generals before. Would seem they had a human side.
Did you think he was good at the time?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He was, you know, particularly after Dunkirk was beaten to Dunkirk, this really needed somebody.
So you had respect for him, but no affection?
Oh, yes. He was good. And, you know, he said, cut out all the dead wood. And I made these things that he said in the conference.
What conference was this? Could you just explain? Because that wasn't on the tape.
Well, once in a while, after he'd been there for, you know, he was going to have a conference of every officer in his command, and we're to go to this cinema. So every officer, no one, if your NCOs aren't good enough to take over, so every officer had to go, I suppose. But the cinema was absolutely full. And then he said something like that. Invasion was considered probable by the Germans, and we were all preparing to meet it. Officers, wives who were present in the area had to get out, and they did. He said the human side would come into it. The first thing they would think of were the wives, were they safe, out with the officers. He said the future of England was at stake. The unfit and incompetent had to be eliminated. The whole army had to be fit on the business and conduct of the battle. But it took him an hour to say.
I believe there was an unusual start as well. Can you just tell us that?
Well, he stood in the middle of the stage.
This is at the cinema?
Yes, in the cinema. Yeah. And the whole stage to himself. We'd been warned no one was to smoke in the cinema before we went in. So we're all there. Every officer was in. So people seeing somebody else. And shuffling, and he stood for, I would say, a full minute in silence, just staring on the human, whatever. And he said, when you're all finished, make yourselves comfortable, stop your coughing and fidgeting, and sit still, because I have something to tell you that I don't want you to forget one word of it. Words there. And then this one word you haven't forget, he went on for a full hour, fairly well repeating it, but knocking it into us that soldiering wasn't what we had been doing. We had to really be prepared for any hour being confronted with some of the enemy.
Did he get any kind of a reception to what he said? I mean,
no, we got absolute silence. No applause at the end, absolute silence, which he demanded.
And you were impressed by what you heard?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. When it got home to me, I'm sure it got, when we all chatted, yes. We said, yes, this is for real. No playing about.
Do you think you needed to be treated like children, or was that going over the top?
Well, this is the way it came over. If we felt we'd been treated like children, we must have appeared to him to be not behaving like children, but something adult had to get through to us, something very serious. Nobody liked him. And the greatest news that came to Southeastern Command was when he was appointed to the 8th Army.